Welcome to the Art of Tracking Radio Show. We interview master trackers from all over and listen to their stories, their knowledge, and information in an attempt to keep the old ways alive. Tracking is still alive and well. Sit back, have a listen.
Hey everyone, this is Weasel Bear. I have a special guest tonight, Jeff Ten Fires Richwa. He's a longtime friend and mentor. I'm actually on location in New Hampshire. Ten Fires is an EMT, he's a wilderness survival instructor, and he is a tracker. And what makes him different than a lot of other trackers is that for the last 30 years, he's been studying the pressure release systems. The pressure release systems, as Ten Fires will talk about, are an old skill that's been passed down for a long time. And, well, hello, Ten Fires. How's it going?
Hey, Rosabear. Thanks for having me. It's going really well. It's good to be back. And I've been looking forward to an opportunity to be able to talk about the what some call pressure releases, depending upon your school of training, or some others may call movement indicators. So I don't want to have a market on any kind of particular term. I'm not advocating any one school over another. I know that there is one predominant principle of teaching out there on this particular subject, but I'm going to be going based on stuff that I've experienced and stuff that I've been really digging into the dirt, doing my dirt time for a very long time. So I've got a pretty good grasp on what I think people are talking about, what I think people are looking for, and what I've been able to prove out scientifically. And I'm always welcoming any kind of feedback and any kind of questions, because there's still so much to learn, and I've never been necessarily taken down into the dirt to see these things that I've been finding. So I've been working with a lot of people over the years, people like yourself who have a lot of passion for tracking and for getting as deeply into the tracks as possible and trying to hash these things out. And I really appreciate you having me here and talking about this stuff. This is good. This is a good thing.
Oh, it's our pleasure. A long time ago, I came across Ten Fires on a tracking forum. It was on the Bear Tracker's Den, Kim Cabrera's website, and there was just a small group of trackers talking, and even back then, Ten Fires was advocating the pressure releases, and he was coming up against a lot of trouble, but...
A lot of differing opinions.
Yeah. I latched on because he seemed to know what he was talking about, and I wanted to learn. And we've became friends, you know. Even over the phone, he would school me through my tracking box, and he was the one who introduced me to the bird language, which I've been obviously we all work on. But he blew me away because he was in New Hampshire and I was in Arkansas, and he knew there was a hawk in my yard by what the robins were saying. And that was awesome. But tonight's talk is on pressure releases. So from what he's told me, there's different classifications or sizes and systems of pressure releases, and they all are very different in the way they are. So I would love to start there.
Okay, so I want to start by just qualifying the movement indicator systems as this goes back, you know, for eons. This isn't any one particular Aboriginal culture. This is hunter-gatherer cultures from around the world. There are master trackers out there all over the place that, you know, aren't from North America. This isn't strictly like a Lipan Apache method of tracking, but the thing is that the movement indicators or pressure releases are going to be consistent, you know, globally. The concepts are going to be the same. This is a universal language, and that's what makes tracking beautiful to me, is that you can apply it to any kind of being that moves. You can apply it to the physics are universal, as I said. It's something that you can apply to any kind of creature or any kind of object that moves across a landscape, that moves across a substrate. So again, I'm not prescribing to any particular culture. I'm talking about these studies that have been passed down for generations and seem to have been kind of lost over the past, well, since intervention anyway. You know, they've seemed to really been disappearing, but thankfully, you know, we have people that are interested in keeping this alive. We have people with passion out there that really want to go as deeply as possible. And what I mean by that is, so, you know, we look at tracks. There are several different ways to look at tracking. Tracking in and of itself is a varied art form. There's a science side of it, and there's an artistic side to it. And the artistic side isn't about being a creative person and making beautiful tracks. The artistic side is going beyond the science or paralleling the science with immersion. And I've actually talked about immersion before. Actually, in the last radio show where I was here, I visited here. We talked about the immersion of the self into the wilderness, into the principles, the philosophy of spiritual awareness, and becoming part of the landscape. The scout skills, being a shadow, and whatnot. So it's kind of the same thing with tracking. You're using your spirit, your experiences, your inner vision, your intuition, whatever you want to call it, to kind of connect yourself to the medium, to the landscape, and to the maker of the tracks, you know? So you're using the science, you're using the physics to read, you know, how, for example, we'll talk about sand, you know, a moist sand, because that's the most popular medium to study. You look at the physics of the moist sand, and it's going to move a certain way, and it's going to stay pretty consistent. And this is something that's really important to touch on, a little tangent here, or a caveat, that the substrate you're reading is going to be different. It's going to throw the same physics, you know, the same movements, but it's going to respond differently depending on what it's made of. And that seems like common sense, but you have to remember that what you see as maybe a grand movement, if we, you know, stick to the names of the most common names of the pressure releases that I think most of you would know. If you're looking at a plate inside of a track, It's a rather large physical movement of sand, of the wet sand. But if you're looking at that same plate in a different substrate, like on a moss or on more of a gravelly surface, it's not going to be as intense. It's not going to be as obvious. It's going to be more subtle. So you kind of have to take your substrate into consideration, and this is where dirt time comes in. You can't learn the movement indicators or the pressure releases and just apply that principle anywhere without understanding the surface you're using. It would be kind of like a painter having a board of colors to choose from, but expecting to be able to create all the effects of painting with one single brush. It's not going to happen. There are several different substrates, several different tools that you need to use. So do your dirt time is basically what I'm getting down to. You can't learn the pressure releases or the movement indicators and not do your dirt time. You have to get in there and apply these principles. Having said that, we know, I'm going to start really basic, as if there are people here that have never really, or may have just gotten into tracking or never really thought about tracking beyond looking at prints in sand or in snow or whatever. So we look at tracks, and one method of tracking, which is fine, it's a very scientific method. It's a very cut and dried method. It's a very I don't mean to be offensive by this, but it's a very in-the-box kind of tracking to me. And this is even, but there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a different style. And this is where I started too. And you kind of have to. We qualify and we quantify. That's how we get a grasp of knowledge. That's how we get a grasp of things that we're doing. So tracking in one sense, one way, if you're into learning about the animals on your landscape and learning, you know, what's out there and how your landscape works, you can look at a set of tracks and you can see impressions going along the ground, for example, and you can take measurements and you can understand toe count and you can understand track morphology and get on, you know, understand the habitat where the animals in your bioregion or what animals are in your bioregion. And you can see what animals are out there at what time of year and what they're doing, and you can kind of follow them around and understand a little bit about how they interact with their landscape. So this is a really good way to get an idea of what kind of animals you have, maybe even a number of, you know, what kind of a population you have or population density. and just kind of get in touch with nature a little bit. You know, if you're a hiker and you just kind of like to know a little bit about what's happening around you, this is a way to get in touch. But then it goes in a little bit deeper, and this is, I think it has a stigma to it when we talk about getting into the deeper movement indicators, because we're not really just looking at the tangible, or how do I put it? We're not looking at what's typically graspable, you know, when you think about tracking. We're getting into a place where some people call it mystical, but let's leave that alone for a second. Let's take that and just kind of put it on a shelf, and we'll kind of connect to that later. I'm still talking about the physical here. I'm still talking about an energetic kind of tracking. So again, let me back up a little bit and start with this. If you stand up and close your eyes, stand on a flat surface and close your eyes, and it helps if you're barefoot or sock-footed, and stand on a hard, flat surface with your eyes closed and relaxed, drop your shoulders, and if you know what dog body is, don't do that. Stay on your heels, stay plantigrade, and take a deep breath into your belly, but put your mind in your feet. You're going to feel yourself move. You'll feel yourself rock in your feet, okay? So you're going to feel the pressure change where your feet are touching the floor. So what that's showing you is that when you breathe, it shows up in your tracks. It goes down to your feet. And it's a very simple principle. It's a very simple concept. Basically, whatever we do, we're constantly fighting gravity. We have to fight gravity as we move, because if we don't, we'll lose our balance and or fall down. So in order to fight gravity, we have to make compensations. And in order to utilize gravity and friction, we have to make compensations. So if I want to run, for example, I need to utilize friction and my muscles and my feet and the gravity that's holding me down. And I need to manipulate that set of elements and push off and run. I have to accelerate. It's a conscious effort to accelerate. So I'm going to throw off these rather large and obvious movement indicators or pressure releases. But even when I'm standing still or while I'm running, I'm also breathing. There's also an autonomic nervous system thing happening. There are things going on that I'm not controlling. I'm blinking and I'm breathing and I'm turning. My heart is beating. There's a lot of stuff happening that's not directly under my control. But my body still has to compensate for these movements, because if it doesn't, again, I will lose my balance. So every little compensation shows up in the tracks. So we have various sets of these pressure releases, movement indicators, and they're most commonly called. You have a set of macro pressure releases, and the macro pressure releases are your grand movements. These are your gross motor movements. And the macro pressure releases you can see on a really large scale. These, again, if you're using the tracker's most common jargon or terms, you'll be talking about plates and plate depth fissures and dishes and discs and things like that. That's what you're going to be looking for, your caves and your ridges and things like that. So these are things that you can see on a really large scale, and they're showing the gross motor movements. These are showing things like running and walking and stopping and waving your arms and whatnot. So they're obvious, you know, and this is kind of where most people that get into tracking may notice these things, and they start to pick them up. You kind of have to pick them up as you go. It's just kind of a natural, like an adoption or a subconscious or an intuitive adoption of these movements. You just see as you're tracking how the soil or the landscape shifts. And it's, you know, also with the distance of tracks apart. If somebody's running, they're going to throw off extremely large plates, for example, to the rear. But they're also going to be throwing off a lot of spatter to the rear. And they're also going to be lengthening their stride. So there's a lot of elements to put together to kind of add up these gross motor movements when you're looking at tracks. But what has to accompany these things are minor movements. So you have majors and minors. Your majors are your major movement indicators or pressure releases are these grand movements. But then the minors, the smaller movements, are separated into macro minors and micro minors. So I don't know. I may have misspoken and said macros earlier, and that was supposed to be talking about majors. The major movements are shown in these grand giant movements. Movement indicators. Those are majors. the minors are the small ones, okay, and they're separated into two categories. From what I'm understanding, there are the macros and there are the micros. And macros are very similar to the major movements, but they're on a really small scale. So you're looking inside of the toes or the digits, and you're looking into the ball mount, and you're looking at different areas of the foot for these discs and dishes and fissures and stuff like that. So they kind of, it's like taking the major movement indicators, pressure releases, and bringing them down to a smaller scale, but you're still looking at the same types of landscape shifts, physical landscape shifts. So that's kind of an easy transition, and they all have different meanings based on where they lie in the tracks. So the thing is, this is where it gets a little bit complicated. If you can actually read tracks to a really good degree and get follow an animal, and get a pretty decent story of what's happening in its life as it's making these tracks, because it's throwing off these gross motor skills. So you'll be able to see, like, if an animal is walking, and you can get kind of an idea of how fast it's walking, and if it's accelerating or decelerating. You can see if an animal is making any major body turns from side to side. You can see if an animal stops and puts its head down or puts its head up, or, you know, turns its head and brings a rear foot up to scratch its ear. These things are really obvious in the major, you know, the big giant pressure releases. So that gives you a pretty good story, you know, in and of itself. But if you look into the next levels, into the minor levels, these macro indicators are going to kind of back up the majors. They're going to kind of be like, they're going to be little confirmations here and there that give you just a little bit of a deeper insight into what the animal is doing. So when you're looking at an animal raising its leg to scratch its ear, the other tracks, the other feet on the ground are compensating for that. So you're going to see these movements on a grand scale in the major movement indicators, but you're also going to see signs inside that track that are going to be like little digital, or if you're looking at a hoof, we're still going to call them digits, but you're still going to be seeing these little discs and dishes and movements in there that kind of back up what you're seeing on the grand scale. So you're only looking at more detail in the track of the body movements of this animal. You're refining the track into telling a deeper story. But you're learning a language here, and that's exactly what tracking is. Tracking is a language that's being scribed on the ground, and it's made up of vocabulary. And from this vocabulary, it forms sentences and paragraphs and pages of a story. So if you don't understand the words of the manuscript, you can't read the manuscript. You might get an idea of what's happening, but in order to know the deeper details, you have to understand the language. You have to understand the dialect. You have to understand the inflections and the intonations. So as you're looking at these tracks more deeply, you're starting to put words together. One single word, one single little digital disc can mean something on its own. It has a representation. But if I throw out a word like can, you actually get a couple of maybe different images in your head of what a can could be. You know, somebody might see a tin can, somebody might see a toilet, somebody might think of the word being able to do something, you can. So the word in and of itself can have a few different meanings, but unless you put it in context with other words, it's kind of standing out on its own. It doesn't give you enough to work with. But you can see that digital disc, but unless you back it up with other discs and other, caves and other, cliffs and whatnot, it's not giving you enough information on its own. So when you're tracking, you've got to start putting words together. And this is done by dirt time. This is done by repetition. This is done by... So what I used to do, for example, is... at the time I was married, when my wife was pregnant, I would have her walk through my sandpit to her disdain. But I would have her walk through my sandpit over and over and over and over and over. And it was like it had to have been thousands of times over the course of months. And she was a trooper. She did it. But it would show me, it would give me an opportunity to get into the footprints and see her major movements of walking and swinging her arms and how her body compensated. but it also gave me an opportunity to see a little bit deeper and watch how she had to make these tinier compensations. Like each digit makes a tiny compensation for the balance that your body is throwing off. So this is all really like physical level stuff, you know, and this is where we draw the line. If you're getting into the minors, the minor macros, that's pretty deep stuff. And it's going to give you could go forever and not learn all the words in that language and not learn all the sentences and dialect of that language. But you can get a pretty good grasp on what's happening by reading these things. So I back it up again in case I, you know, made a mistake with my words before. You have your macros, that's your big stuff, that's giant, that's gross motor stuff. You have, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah, just like kick me, because you're right here with me, and we've been having a good time. This is actually pretty, I'm so happy that he's here, but I need you to kick me if I screw that up. I don't know why my brain is going that way tonight. So majors, you have your majors. That's your big stuff. The major movements are the walking and the running and the decelerations, the big body turns, arms swinging a baseball bat. That's your major stuff. The minors are divided into the macros and the micros. So the macros are the next level. It's kind of like taking the majors and bringing them down a notch and going deeper into the track. You're actually reading off the floor and the walls of the track. But then what happens is we kind of move over the line of the physical into, it's still the physical, but it's really more of an energetic physical. So you got to kind of bear with me here. Hold on, let me take a sip of water. This is kind of the area where people get nervous, and it has the stigma attached to it. Reading tracks in and of itself, it's scientifically provable. You can reproduce these movement indicators or pressure releases easily. It's just such a simple thing to go in and do a turn and show a plate and a plate dash fissure to whatever degree the turn is. It's so easy to reproduce these majors and macro minors. That's not a problem. But when you get into the micro minors, yeah, they're reproducible, but they're squirrely and they're very hard to see. And they represent everything from the way that the fascia under your skin moves with the muscles to your smooth muscles inside of your body constricting or dilating to liquid inside of your body sloshing around. These show tiny muscular movements, you know, like blinking, you know, and even if you kind of like lick your lips as you're walking, all this stuff has to show up in your tracks. It can't not. It's not really, the funny thing though is it gets complicated because you're not actually seeing, like if I stick my tongue out now as I'm standing up, my body compensates for me sticking my tongue out. You're not actually seeing me stick my tongue out in the track. You're seeing my body's compensation for it. So it's almost like you're reading the negative to understand the positive. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's really how it works. So a lot of things that you're reading in the tracks, you're going to see happening on the opposite side of the body from where they're located, where you think they would be located in the track. So if I raise my right arm out to the right, for example, you're going to see compensations on the left side of my tracks. You know, if you're carrying a very heavy thing in your right hand and you walk, you're going to see compensation in the left side of both of your prints. You're seeing macros and majors, but you're really seeing a lot of macro activity to show that. So try that. Get out and, you know, get it, you know, so if you have snow or a tracking box or sand, whatever, and pick up something that's a good, you know, 30, 40 pounds in your right hand and take a few steps and you will see the changes, the compensation show up on the left outside ball mount and the right inside ball mount. So to be opposite of where your actual arm is located or your arm is actually located in your footprint. So the cool thing about this, now we're going to get into the micro stuff. So like I was saying, as we get into the micro minors, and I need to apologize for switching terms earlier. This is, there's so many terms for this stuff and it's been a lot of years. And I started getting away from using the terms and just looking at the track. So bear with me. So we're looking at the micro minors now. We're looking at this different scale of interpreting what's happening in a footprint or reading what's happening in a footprint. And the cool thing is that if you understand energy flow, like if you're into Reiki or Tai Chi or anything, you know, you understand how energy flows. We have these channels through the body, and it's kind of neat because you can almost look at it like a magnet. If you could see a magnet and how the magnetism flows through the poles out one end and then back around into the other end, it creates this constant loop of energy, this constant energy flow. We kind of do the same thing. We're magnetic creatures. We're actually, you know, we're connected to Grandmother Earth in a way that we have this constant energy flow running through us, looping through us and connecting us to the ground. All energy seeks ground in some capacity. And energy can't be destroyed and it can't be created. It's just what it is. And it takes different forms. But it's always flowing. This is not uncommon knowledge. This is not new information. Really, this is something that everybody knows at this point, and it's being proven more and more and more over time. There's really nothing mystical about it, and you know, there's really nothing mystical about the mystical either. We just haven't gotten there to figure it out yet because we still quantify. We still need to look at things in a box. We still need to measure it, and you can't do that when you get into this energy realm, into the things that go beyond the physical, tangible world. So, having said that, if you look at reflexology, you can kind of get a grasp of how the energy flows in that it goes through the body from a point in the body, like say from your right shoulder. You have channels that run down, you know, through your body, chi channels or ki channels. And ultimately, you have a connection to the ground where these channels end at your feet, or they make a connection at your feet. They transition at your feet. I don't want to say they end because that's too terminal, and they don't actually end. But they do come down to your feet and they make a connection to the ground. So the energy is constantly flowing. And the neat thing is, again, if you look at reflexology, check out a chart, the way that the energy is lined up in the foot, you know, the locations of energy points that represent the body, it's kind of pretty accurate to tracking. This is what you can use as a really good guideline for tracking. So if you're looking at a reflexology chart, you can see that the ears are in the upper ball mount at the top, just under the toes, you know, at the toe ridges. But just under the toes, you can see the ears, unlike the one, two, three, third, fourth toes. The eyes are going to be under the second toe to third toe. Same place up in the upper ball mount on the top edge. You can see that the heart is, you know, just kind of line it up. The heart's going to be more in the center of the foot, but towards the inside ball mount. And then everything kind of follows going down the foot. It kind of follows suit along with how the body works. The inside of the foot, the inner ball mount down to the inner heel, that's going to be more visceral, you know, and spinal. So your visceral into your spinal column going inward. As you go to the outside of the foot, the outer ball mounts, the outer edges, you're looking at more musculoskeletal. So you're going to see your shoulders and arms there. You're going to see your legs, your thighs, your knees, stuff like that are running, but still from top to bottom down the outer edge of the foot, musculoskeletal. And then in the middle, you just got everything happening. So, you know, small intestines, you know, your liver, your stomach and stuff like that. Your core is really kind of smack in the middle of the foot, but leaning again more towards the inner edge of the inner ball mount down, you know, where it all comes into your spine ultimately. So just, you know, look at a reflexology chart. It makes sense. But cross-reference. Check out a couple of different charts or several different charts and kind of see where things are consistent and where they're not. And then you kind of just have to prove it out as you go, and you'll figure it out. This is something that I took the time to do years and years and years to do. So you'll figure it out. Weasel Bear and I, as we were doing this, we actually got the foot divided into different segments and quadrants. We were making the toes into quadrants because we were trying to do this long distance. So we actually had to get things down into this system where we could communicate it with each other. Taking pictures of these energetic indicators doesn't do it justice. You have to do this. You really should do it in person with somebody, but if this is what you have, if you can get some really good, high-quality, high-focused, like, what do you call it? Is that the macro lens where you're, like, really wit so you can see, like, grains of not even sand, but grit. If you can get to that level and see dust and grit, you are where you need to be to see these energetic movements or energetic indicators. So we had this foot chart going along that worked out pretty well. But the best thing to do is really just do it yourself. Get down into it and check it out. The finer the substrate, like if you could throw down like baking flour, that would be pretty good. Talcum powder, stuff like anything that's really fine will give you a really more detailed reading of what you're looking for. So you're looking at like this reflexology chart. You're going to start to notice as you make a footprint and kind of coordinate things, when you look for these really minuscule movements, you have to kind of think about how they're formed in the first place in order to understand what you're finding. And I think one of the best ways to illustrate it is to, I don't know if you grew up in my generation, I'm 45, so, you know, we had all the really cool Bill Nye the Science Guy stuff. When I was a kid, we were doing science experiments on a really basic level, but they were pretty cool things in my science classes. So we did the simple stuff, you know, the stuff that seemed like it was magical when I was a kid. And one of the things that we did, many of you may remember, is to run a stream of water so that it's like from a faucet, from like so that it's almost like a pencil-thin stream of water, a very smooth pencil-thin stream of water, and then take a plastic comb and run it through your hair, or comb your dog, or if you have a sheep or whatever, you know, anything that's going to give you some static electricity. And then kind of bring the comb towards the water stream without touching it, and the stream will bend significantly. So doing this kind of gives you an understanding, or you know, one of those, a grasp that you can see, because we're a very see-it-to-believe-it species. But if you can see how the water bends, you'll understand, or if you've ever been zapped, you know, when somebody walks across the floor with socks on and touches you, and that you get that little blue spark of electricity, that's what we have. We have raw energy running through us constantly in these loops and connecting to the ground. So your physical body is making these grand movements and these not so grand movements. So you have your major stuff and then you have your macro stuff. But then also the energy that's coursing through your body is affecting the substrate as well. So when you move across the substrate, like if it's sand, some of the sand is going to connect to your foot and it's going to stick to your foot. And, you know, that could be because of just, you know, chemistry, the way water on the bottom of your foot might kind of connect and bond and create a little bit of glue for the sand to hold on. But also, some of it's going to stick just because of static electricity. But the static electricity, the electricity running through your body, the energy is affecting the substrate. So it's going to leave impressions. So this is where it's kind of like people get, you know, a little bit, squeamish about it, or they leery, I guess is a good way to say it. Because this is almost like, well, you're just reading tea leaves, you know, you're finding shapes that aren't there. You're reading things that aren't actually there. Your mind is making stuff up to see. But no, it's not. You're not doing that. You know, you're not reading somebody's fortune. You're not making anything up. You're not building anything out of what's there. You're just seeing it. You're recognizing things that are already there and have a very distinct purpose. They have a very distinct definition or a very distinct meaning. So you're looking for letters to build words to create these sentences and read this page out of the creature's life. So when you're looking in there, and this is kind of hard to do without being able to show it, but keep in mind that you're looking on a very small level and you're looking for like little, you're looking for very tiny shapes. You're looking for very tiny movements or placements of dust and grit on top of the sand or within the sand, even the sand itself.
I'm gonna try to have some pictures and some shapes in the picture section of this. So
that'd be good. That'd
maybe
be
like perfect. Maybe our grid map that, you know, all that.
Perfect. Yeah, that would be great. So what we'll try to do then is highlight some of these shapes, and maybe you can kind of get a better grasp on what I'm talking about. But the thing is, you're going to see these shapes, and there are thousands of combinations of how these are put together to create a language. So I don't remember, because I went so long ago to the school, I don't remember exactly what the number was. It's like 1,600 different pressure releases, indicators, or whatnot. And but the thing is that this all it creates a language, like I said. So you got to kind of start putting it together. It takes a long, this is like information that was established over how many, you know, eons, how many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years of hunter-gatherer societies needing to be connected to their landscape, you know, needing to be connected to their food sources, needing to live with the animals. They needed to understand what was happening on their landscape and who was there. And not just the animals they hunted, but their family. They could read each other's footprints and know who, you know, family members. And they knew where, when enemies were around, you know, or just, you know, travelers, visitors, strangers. They had to be connected to their environment that way. They also understood the bird language, the alarms. They understood the ripples. They understood inner vision or intuition. And they lived by this. This is how they stayed connected. This was their iPhones or their Androids or whatever. This is how, this was their internet, you know, but it was on an energy level that came directly from them and through them. So what you're going to notice is when you're looking at these energetic indicators, these micro miners or whatever you want to call them, you'll see shapes, you'll see triangles, and you'll see circles, and you'll see circles with dots in them, and you're going to see zigzags, and you're going to see chains, and you're going to see squares and rectangles and all kinds of different shapes. So one of my favorite ones, I'm going to give, here's a freebie. This is one of the best ones that I figured out when I really started getting into this. And it's a great, it's almost, I hate to say it, but it's actually almost kind of a cool party trick if you wanted to go so far as to, you know, give it a tongue-in-cheek, silly definition. But it works really well. It's a very blatant indicator. And I'm going to get, I need to also be, I need to make a discernment or specify the difference between an indicator and an identifier as well. So I'm going to come back to that too. And by the way, so we pulled that thing off the shelf about the stigma of tracking on the energy levels and why people kind of tend to go toward it being a mystical thing. But it's not. It's really just science that, you know, you got to kind of reach deep down into to get. Anyway, so this particular one, this is kind of cool. You full bladder, half full bladder, empty bladder, very obvious indicator. And if you look at a reflexology chart, you'll see where the groin indicator is. And it's kind of neat because you're going to get, so you have liquid in a bag in your body, basically, and this liquid is sloshing around as you're moving. And if your body is not, if you don't have a lot of liquid in your bladder, this indicator isn't going to be as prevalent. But the more liquid in your bladder, the more prevalent this indicator becomes. And what I've noticed is that when your bladder is empty in the indicator area of the groin, you're going to find kind of like a squiggle. It's almost like a deflated balloon, like a long, one of those really long, like a clown would use to make animals, to tie animals, like one of those really long balloons, but deflated and kind of just squiggly flat lying on the ground. That's kind of what you're looking for, but it's tiny. We're talking millimeters, maybe 2 or 3 millimeters in length, you know, and maybe what, a millimeter, if that, in width in that area. And this is made of the dust and grit. But what can happen is as the bladder fills up, it starts to take shape. So half, like a half full bladder is going to throw what I have been calling like a boomerang. It distinctly looks like a boomerang in that area. And it can go, it doesn't matter which direction it points, it can go either way. And this is my experience. This is what I've seen. I'm not saying I'm right or wrong, or I'm not saying this is the only thing. You know, there's so much squirrely stuff happening in the floor of the track and on the walls of the track from these energy releases. This is what I found to be the most prevalent one for bladder indicator. Anyway, it's like a boomerang shape. And then as the bladder gets really full, it turns into like this really intensely sharp hockey stick, the end of a hockey stick. It's like a check mark, but it's a fat check mark. It's like a square and a rectangle. You know, the square is connected at one end of the rectangle just off to the side. And it, you know, that's full bladder. That means that you're going to find, you know, relatively soon that this person had to stop at a tree, or they had to find a bathroom, or they peed themselves, because that's full bladder. If you get any fuller than that, you're in trouble. So check it out. You know, get in there, and that indicator is that can be big. That can be you know, a centimeter long by half a centimeter wide. But check it out. Get in there and see if you can find it. And if you don't see the bladder indicator in relatively easily, you just got to look a little deeper. You got to look a little harder. It's there. It's very, very significant.
We're talking about looking in tracking boxes or being outside looking in a good substrate, but making a tracking box is really easy. And you know, you want sand that's moist, wet, not soaking wet. Apparently the best is when you pick it up and when you let go, it's a ball, but it begins to crack. And right now we have one that's 2 foot wide and 4 foot long, and the sand is about 4 feet, 4 inches deep. And it's doing everything that we need it to do. And so it's right here in the house, and you don't have to go get expensive stuff and go miles away. You can have anything, and you can have it right in your house for constant practice.
Ideally, if you can do a box where you can do like a minimum of 2 steps. 3 would be great, but a minimum of 2 steps. And I'm going to qualify this in a little bit, talking about the third track concept as well. But if you can do 2 steps, you'll be able to read a lot more and coordinate these indicators a lot more easily, a lot more readily. And like Weasel Bear is saying, it's not really about the depth of the sand, but it should be fine sand. Take any impurities out, get any gravel out, or any, you know, if you're getting it from outside, take out pine needles and acorn shells or whatever you might have in that area. Get it out of there. Make it as fine as possible because you want ideal. This is something for which you need ideal circumstances. And then you can translate it to the less ideal circumstances later on. But the reason it needs to be fine is because you need the dust and grit. It's not about the sand. It's about the dust and grit within the sand. That's what's going to give you these energetic indicators. So, and it doesn't have to be deep. It can be half an inch deep. You know, I made a tracking box once out of strapping. So it's like a half inch wide boards on a piece of plywood, on a trash bag, on a piece of plywood, black plastic on plywood. And that's all I had for sand. It was about a half inch deep, if that. And I used that for a really long time inside. It was convenient to stick under the coffee table or under the couch and then slide it out. And I could take 3 or 4 steps in that tracking box and it worked. Oh, here I am talking about these indicators for years and years. That's what I used. And so it doesn't have to be extravagant. Just do what you can. But if you can get 2 steps in the box, that makes the best sense. So I kind of want to go over the difference real quick, then we'll get into the third track concept. But the difference between an indicator and an identifier, as I've come to understand it, again, it's terminology. I may very well have them backwards according to some, who knows. But I'm going to tell you how the way I understand it. You take it and you run with it. Prove me wrong, prove me right. Make up your own words. It doesn't really matter. It just get an understanding of it. So we have movement indicators that show the movement of the body. So they have they show up consistently as you do the same thing. So if I'm taking a step and I'm looking to the right on my right foot, I'm going to see a very significant indicator, and I will tell you it can kind of look like a teardrop, and that's all I'm going to say. The rest is up to you to figure out. But I can see a very specific movement indicator showing that I'm turning my head to the right, and where to the right, what degree, like on a clock. Am I looking at 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock? How far am I turning my head? And it's going to show up in these indicators. And there's always a bunch of checks and balances. So when you do something with your body, the rest of your body reacts to it. So you're going to see a lot of checks and balances, and you have to start putting these together. You can't depend on one single indicator to show a movement. Now, you know, you can kind of make an assumption or make a guesstimate and kind of get yourself down a direction of thought or a direction of interpretation, but please don't get stuck on, this is what gets us these bad wraps, these stigmas where people start to, you don't want to, you want the pill, you know, the insta pill, insta information. You don't want to do the dirt time and figure it out, but you have to. You can't speak a language with just a select few keywords. You know, you're not speaking Spanish if all you can say is tortilla and perro. You know, it's, you got to be able to say, you got to be able to put stuff together. You got to live in the culture and get the language. So learn these indicators and learn what backs them up, you know, and do it consistently, reproduce it, do the same motion over and over and over until you know without a doubt that somebody could come in, walk through the box for you, do a motion, and you could point out and find these same types of indicators in that track. The physics is the same for everyone, but the way that things line up can be different for each person because, like, if I turn my head to the right, for example, I might have a crick in my neck, and it's going to affect me, and it's actually going to throw up really interesting indicators. But that's for me. Another person might not have the same crick in their neck, but they might have, you know, who knows, like a sore hip or a bad knee or whatever. So the indicators for the turn are going to be there, but you're also going to see other things, and their body's just going to compensate differently. So you need to be able to read these things, and it should be consistent for this person every time they do that relatively consistent every time they do that motion. But we're, you know, we're always fluctuating, we're always changing, we're always doing different things. Nothing's ever seems the same, but you kind of have to figure out how these words go together. And this is where it kind of gets interesting, because talking about identifiers. So I am going to have, I don't remember how many it is. I think we have like 64 identifiers in every foot, in our own footprints, 64 points of reference, something to that effect, where a fingerprint had, I don't remember the last time it was studied, it was like 9 or 12 or 14 or something. The point is that a footprint is more accurate to identify a creature than a fingerprint. So, and it's not about reading, so you got to be very careful about this. It's not about reading the ridges in your skin on the ground. That's not identifiers. That's fingerprints, basically, but with your toes. We're not reading the fingerprint of the toe. We're not reading how the loops are in your toe skin. That's not it. What we're reading is how your energy moves through your foot, and how your skin responds to the way that you move, and how different things in your body affect the way that you move. So if you have a replaced knee, for example, on your left side, so you've had a left knee replacement and you have pins or whatever, every time you take a step, that replaced knee, that surgery is going to show up in your track in a certain place. That's an identifier for you. If you have any kind of injury in your hip, if you've ever had an appendix removed, or, you know, even just because of your stature, the way you're built, if you're muscular, if you're overweight, and the way that you carry yourself, all these things, everything that you do with the way that you move show up in your tracks. But as identifiers, they're always there. They're never not there. They have no, the way you move, like if you're running or walking or whatever, has zero bearing on these identifiers. They show up for you every single time you make a track, because it's just the way that your body moves. It's the way that you are. It's structurally the way that you are. Okay? It's nothing to do with movement. It's structurally the way that you carry yourself, the way that you are built, and whatever surgery.